On the program today, a whole lot of macroeconomics, gang. Healthcare, housing, and distressed debt. But we will make you want to listen. I promise you that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today. This one is the 11th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Let us begin, shall we, with a couple of facts from the news the past couple of days, and then a couple of not entirely hypothetical questions. Fact number one, Russia's finance minister said today that his country is going to sue if the West tries to force it into defaulting on its foreign debt. We've talked about this a little bit, right? Russia has been largely shut out of the international finance system. The catch, of course, is that you need the international finance system to be able to pay on your bonds. So that's a challenge. Not hypothetical question number one, then, is who are you going to sue and on what grounds? So there's that. News fact number two is that S&P, the ratings agency, says Russia has now slipped into what is called selective default, a term of art, really, used when a country defaults on a specific payment, but not its entire debt. And that gets us to not hypothetical question number two, which is, who is going to be buying any of that Russian debt now anyway? Marketplace's Lily Jamali gets us going.
Unlike most countries that default on debt, Russia has the money. It's got plenty coming in, given that EU sanctions don't touch its lucrative oil and gas exports, says Chris Miller with the Fletcher School at Tufts.
Russia's budget is balanced, for example. It's got very little government debt, but is unable to repay due to restrictions that foreign governments have put in place.
And that inability to pay can make borrowing money, even from those willing to lend to Russia, a lot more expensive. Miller says as most investors flee,
that creates potentially what some investors see to be a buying opportunity.
What kind of investor might be drawn to Russia right now?
I mean, it's the usual kind of vulture fund style people, that very litigious style investor.
That's Timothy Ash, a sovereign debt strategist at Blue Bay Asset Management in London. He says a strategy those investors might be considering is buying Russian debt now when it's cheap and later seizing Russian assets if necessary.
You know, get them sold off and get the cash raised from those assets to pay bondholders, essentially.
To ensure they get their money's worth. Still, one big reason even the world's most litigious vulture investors might balk is risk to their reputations, says Georgetown Law Professor Anna Gelpern.
I remember a lot of people have already sort of edged out of this space because of sanctions. Of course, that means that the people who stay could get a fabulous reward.
But the risks, including the odds the current default could affect Russia's economy for years, might not be worth it. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, one word, four letters. No, it's not the one you think, even with all that red across the board. B-O-N-D. Okay, yes, S, fine, that's five. Bonds. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The aviation tracking site FlightAware says airlines canceled more than 300 flights in the United States today after canceling more than 500 yesterday. Weather-induced logistics problems, the airlines say, and notably staffing shortages have made for a pretty bumpy ride of late, on top of which airports, the TSA says, are now handling nearly as many passengers day-to-day as they were in the before times. And as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, that could make for a rough spring and summer for the flying public.
Domestic air travel, flying inside the U.S. for family or fun, is projected to hit new records this spring and summer. It's all about pent-up demand. And rising ticket prices don't seem to matter much, says Birkett Huey at Morningstar.
You know, people want to travel again. And from what the airlines are saying, they've been able to increase prices in response to increased costs.
For both aviation fuel and labor. After letting a lot of workers go earlier in the pandemic, they're now trying to ramp up hiring fast. They're boosting pay, offering incentives for existing employees to take more shifts. But there are still big headwinds, says Tim Donahue at air travel analytics firm Airology. starting with getting more pilots in the cockpit.
That training process has a bottleneck for simulator time. There's bottlenecks for essentially instructors that sign off pilots right before they enter the line.
The big national and international carriers are poaching pilots from smaller regional carriers. It can also be hard to attract and retain flight attendants in the face of air rage in the cabin. And the lowest paid workers in customer service and baggage have other options. So, does Donahue think airlines will get things running smoothly by summer?
Unfortunately, I'd have to say probably not.
With airlines flying more and fuller flights, he says we can expect air traffic control to be overtaxed, leading to even more delays. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Not to anthropomorphize it too much, but it's pretty clear this virus has learned through the course of the pandemic. See also all the variants and mutations that keep catching us people by surprise. Thing is, us people have learned too, especially in places where COVID hit really hard really early and showed us where some of the gaps in our healthcare systems are. So now, healthcare providers are using those lessons learned to shape how they grow. From WPLN in Nashville, Blake Farmer reports.
The southeast suburbs of Nashville stood out on COVID heat maps. In the early months, two zip codes accounted for 40% of all the city's cases. It just so happens the area is about as far as you can get in town from the medical district. Now that's changing.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. We are all so grateful.
At an announcement in March, City Councilmember Joy Stiles praises Vanderbilt University Medical Center. Behind her, a largely vacant shopping mall. Vanderbilt plans to turn it into another mammoth medical office, and its CEO cites the high rates of COVID as a big reason for the investment. It's at the center of some of the most diverse neighborhoods in Tennessee. Many residents are Black and Latino, and they're also refugees who've moved here from around the globe. Dr. Consuelo Wilkins, who oversees health equity at Vanderbilt, says residents are more likely to live in multi-generational households and have hands-on jobs that don't allow for telecommuting.
These are people early on that we were saying the essential workers.
Even before the pandemic, there was evidence this area was underserved, Wilkins says, with fewer people who have health insurance.
But the spotlight that a lot of people have talked about being shown on this is something that, you know, COVID brought that's really hard to ignore.
COVID isn't the only reason projects are moving forward, but regulatory filings show the pandemic is providing additional justification for many expansion applications to state regulators. In some cases, states are encouraging COVID-related expansions. In recent weeks, Tennessee set aside the last of its federal stimulus funding, about $230 million, in part to help hospitals in one-time hotspots to build more intensive care units. The pandemic has even revived interest in reopening rural hospitals abandoned for years. Dr. Ale Hamdani is an emergency physician who worked in a shuttered West Tennessee facility.
If anything, this whole pandemic has taught us there's greater need than ever before.
Hamdani now runs the ER in a neighboring county for a company attempting to reopen his old hospital and others. Some are in counties with COVID death rates that are 50% higher than the national average. Hamdani says a pre-pandemic assumption that rural residents who lost their hospitals could just drive to bigger cities turned out to be wrong. During COVID surges, even urban medical centers were overwhelmed.
There's no beds anywhere. Right. And what are patients supposed to do? Just die on the street?
But the aspiration to meet needs highlighted by COVID are coming up against another trend. Health systems are having trouble just finding nurses to staff their existing operations. So in yet another way, the pandemic's beginning to shape growth. The Ascension Health System's main hospital in Nashville is finishing up a big renovation. Dr. Shubhada Jagesha, the CEO, says plans were overhauled midstream with an eye on making life easier on nurses in hopes of improving recruitment and retention. Basic stuff like supply closets for nurses closer to patient rooms to cut down on walking, and locker rooms with showers.
Not being cognizant of the fact that they have additional needs that we can plan for and intentionally deliver on seems short-sighted.
Broadly, there's a recognition that COVID didn't so much create new needs, but reveal those that have existed beneath the surface and will remain even if the pandemic fades away. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we have to do whatever it takes to get this house.
Gotta do what you gotta do. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is down 413 today, 1.1%, finished at 34,308. The NASDAQ down 299, 2.1% there, closed at 13,411. The S&P 500 down 75 points, about 1.7%, ended things at 44.12. Number of banks kick off first quarter earnings season this week. J.P. Morgan posts results on Wednesday. Today in advance, picked up 0.3%. Citigroup posts on Thursday, slipped 0.6%. AT&T rang up 7.4% today after spinning off its water media business to Discovery in a deal that we've talked about a lot the last couple of months. Shares of the new company, ticker symbol WBD, Warner Brothers Discovery, up 1.4%. I mentioned bonds. Yield on the 10-year, 2.77%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Come tomorrow morning, long about 8:30 Washington time, you're going to see a whole lot of headlines making comparisons to the Reagan administration, the first term, no less, 40-some-odd years ago, and how the inflation that we are seeing now was last seen back then. The good people at the Department of Labor are going to clue us into the latest reading on the Consumer Price Index tomorrow, and the data will, once again, and I'm pretty sure I'm not giving anything away here, show rising prices for just about everything, including food, milk, veggies, chicken fingers, which I mentioned because schools, which feed millions of kids every day, are watching those prices and are getting nervous. During the pandemic, a lot of schools were able to offer lunch to students for free. They had a waiver from the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, to do it. But that waiver is set to go away on June the 30th. And meanwhile, those chicken finger school lunches just keep getting pricier. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more on that.
NOAA Atlas tries to give the people what they want. In this case, the people are the students of Anoka Hennepin School District, north of the Twin Cities. And what they want is tater tot casserole, or as they call it in Minnesota, hot dish.
We had our guests this year, they were asking, can we get tater tot hot dish? Well, we've never really served it, or not in a long time.
Thing is, tater tots are kind of pricey right now.
And as we were looking at that recipe, we were saying, which potato is going to cost us less as we make it, and will still taste just as good?
Next year at Jefferson County Public Schools near Denver, Colorado, students will pay a dollar more for lunch than they were paying in 2019, before it was free. That's a 30% increase. Beth Wallace leads food and nutrition services for the district.
It's very disheartening. I think mainly because I know there's families that won't be able to afford that amount, so that means they won't participate with us.
And if fewer kids participate in school lunches, either because they can't afford them or because they don't want to be seen getting free lunch, that could lead to a negative spiral, says Carolyn Vega with the nonprofit Share Our Strength.
If these school nutrition departments can't make it work, you know, they're going to have to scale back what they're able to offer. That may affect participation. That means even less money coming in, which makes it even more challenging to meet the requirements.
The thing about having tater tot casserole without tater tots is that kids can be pretty fickle when it comes to food. And if they don't like what school districts can afford to feed them, they might just skip lunch altogether. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
The latest report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that's the UN's main global warming group, their report was out last week with a somewhat grim forecast that humanity can pull itself back from the brink, but it ain't going to be easy. And one big culprit? Cities. In 2020, cities were responsible for as much as 72% of greenhouse gas emissions. And the solution, says the IPCC, is to start making both our cities and the buildings in them more sustainable. That is also, as it happens, the theme of architect and urban designer Stefan Ahl's new book. It's called Supertall, about the history of supertall buildings and how we can better design them to save the planet. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Excited to be here.
Is there a difference between merely tall buildings and the supertalls of which you write in this book?
Yeah, there's a technical difference in that, like, a supertall is considered a structure taller than 300 meters or roughly, you know, 1,000 feet. So there's few of them. But what's interesting is that, you know, up until, you know, the mid 20th century, there was only two of them, the Chrysler Building and the Empire State Building. And now there's more than 100. So we've seen really like an explosion of these extremely tall buildings across the globe.
One of the threads in this book that struck me was your concern with sustainability, both the materials that we use, the concrete and the steel, and the environmental impact that they have, and what that density means. So here's my question, and I ask this as a guy living in Los Angeles, right, famous for its sprawl. What's worse, sprawl or density?
You know, if density is done right, it's really a great model for urban living. And, you know, one of the biggest culprits of unsustainable urbanization is the car, because roughly it takes about 5 times more energy to move someone by car rather than public transportation. So that's a lot of transport energy wasted. And, you know, you can imagine today with gas prices skyrocketing, that's a pretty big topic. So having a city that is compact with relatively kind of medium to high density where people can walk or take public transportation is much better from a transportation energy perspective. Now, at the same time, building a tall building, you know, requires more materials, more structure, right? So it is a complicated formula. But generally speaking, when we're talking about cities with like medium to high density, they tend to be better on the environment.
What do you think it says, actually, for the future of supertall, that we are increasingly becoming an urbanized world, right? I mean, some overwhelming percentage of the planet's population is urban and will even be more so in the years to come.
I think there's a lot of good things about it, meaning that, you know, as we build taller and more compact, we're learning a lot about technology, right? We're learning about materials, how to make them stronger, like the concrete, or using alternatives to concrete like mass timber. We're learning about structures, how to make them more efficient. And what's so interesting about the story of the skyscraper is that it kind of really is built upon the inventions of many, many successive generations, right? You can trace it back all the way in time to the Romans who invented concrete, or even further back to something as crude as Stonehenge, right, where you had one of the first structures. It has taken thousands of years to put all these inventions together to create this kind of society that we live in today, and that really fascinates me.
Is that progress from Stonehenge to the supertalls? All right, and I'm asking, you know, again, a guy who wrote the book on this, but is that a net positive for us as a people, or do you think it's we could have done something else and done it better?
I think if you're looking at the evolution of progress, it always cuts both ways, and it kind of shows that technology is a double-edged sword. On one hand, it allows us to reach into the skies, right, and create these mind-bending structures. At the same time, they also put serious harm on our planet, and in many cases also kind of represent inequity, right? If you look at the, kind of the latest super talls in the New York skyline, they're like these ultra skinny building for the world's richest people, many of whom don't even live there. I think it's a complicated topic. It can really cut both ways. In a way, they're like, you know, vessels of human possibilities. They're like moonshots of what we as a civilization can achieve. But there's definitely environmental and social implications.
Stefan Al, he's an architect, urban designer as well, and an author most recently of a book called Super Tall. Stefan, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. It was a true pleasure.
I mentioned the yield on the 10-year Treasury earlier. Yes, historically low still, to be clear, but it is back up to where it was in January of 2019, 2.77%. Another interest rate of macroeconomic interest right now. The average rate on a 30-year mortgage hit 4.72% the first week of April, the highest that has been since 2018. And look, mortgage rates are supposed to go up as the Fed tightens up on interest rates. But one thing that happens when that happens is that houses get less affordable. So one way you might find a deal in a hot housing market with rising interest rates, maybe rolling the dice on a fixer-upper, huh? Here's today's installment of our series, Adventures in Housing.
My name is Shay Davison. I am a stay-at-home mom of four from Patriot, Ohio. Down the road from where I grew up was this house that I was obsessed with. It's made of logs, and yet there's an elegance about it. You see dark red wood, and then glass, all kinds of glass. And it was always so intriguing for me. As a kid, I would just press my face up against my car window in the back and just think, I gotta be in that house. When it came up for sale, I immediately thought, I would love this house, but I cannot afford this house. But then months went by. And so I thought, what do I have to lose? You know, we're looking for a home. We've been renting for so long. What will it hurt to check it out? The prior tenants who had owned it both died. We finally got a hold of the daughter that was selling the home. They had $80,000 in debt on it, and that's all that they were asking for it. And immediately, as soon as we got in the car, I turned to my husband and I said, we have to get this place. We have to do whatever it takes to get this house. During inspection, we found out what the catch was, and that was the astronomical amount of work that needed to be done to it to make it livable. No mortgage company would approve a home that they didn't consider insurable or safe to live in. So the way that we were able to work out a deal with the sellers was we said, don't worry about anything, we'll take care of it. They basically left the place open and I came every single day. We had to rip out 1,800 square feet of deck because it was an insurance liability. We had to get three huge dump trucks full of garbage out. We had to replace the vent systems. It was months and months of work before we could even have the mortgage approved for the home. But until the sellers signed the paperwork, we weren't sure. And even as we sat there with the lawyer waiting for the sellers, he kept saying, don't hold your breath. Don't hold your breath. And that's a nerve-wracking place to exist, but it made that thrill that came with actually having the house the most wonderful feeling in the world. I'm just over the moon to have this house that I've always dreamed of.
That is quite the story, huh? Shay Davison in Patriot, Ohio there. Tell us about your adventure in housing, would you? Even if it's like Shay's, holy cow. Marketplace.org is where you can do that. This final note on the way out today, I've been gone, so I'm not sure how much we did on this last week, but all of those reports about Elon Musk joining the Twitter board after news broke that he owned something like 9.2% of the company? Yeah, not so fast. CEO Parag Agrawal put out a statement today that said, in operative part, Elon Musk has decided not to join our board. And then he went on, and he wrote this, "We believe that having Elon as a fiduciary of the company, where he, like all board members, has to act in the best interest of the company and all of our shareholders, was the best path forward." You don't have to read between the lines too closely to deduce that perhaps Musk decided being on the outside is more fun than being on the inside. I mean, Musk could buy that whole company and still have something like $150 billion left over. Anyway, here's your moment of economic context, not Musk-related. I know it doesn't feel like it when you go by the corner gas station, but crude oil, West Texas Intermediate, the U.S. benchmark to be precise, is down 24% from its high a month or so ago. Our daily production team includes Anis Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.